I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is child psychologist and author Allison Gopnik. She's joined in conversation by social psychologist Dacher Keltner. And now join Risa Young on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Allison Gopnik and Dacher Keltner.
Developmental psychologist Allison Gopnik is an award-winning professor of psychology and an affiliate professor of philosophy at the University of California at Berkeley. She has devoted much of her time to studying the minds of babies and young children. In her best-selling books, including The Philosophical Baby and The Scientist in the Crib, she argues that the complex minds of children and the way they approach the world can help us better understand the human condition. In her latest book, The Carpenter and the Gardener, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children, she contends that children are such naturals at learning and playing and innovating that parents should just loosen up and let them do their own thing. She writes, quote, "We can't make children learn, but we can let them learn." Appearing in conversation with Allison Gopnik this evening is Dacher Keltner, founding director of Greater Good Science Center and a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. Dacher is a renowned expert in the biological and evolutionary origins of human emotion, and he is the author of the best-selling Born to Be Good, The Compassionate Instinct, and The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. Please join me in welcoming Allison to our community.
Thank you so much, all of you, for being here. And thanks for inviting me. What I'm going to do is just very briefly talk about a little bit of the stuff that I talk about in the book. And let me say something about how I came to write this book. I originally was thinking of trying to write something about two really remarkable scientific developments in our understanding of children that have unfolded over the past 20 years or so. And one of them is a whole new line of work about the evolution of childhood, about why it is that we have this really distinctive long period of childhood. And the other line of research, which is more like specifically the research that I do, is about how children learn, about the really amazing learning capacities they have, and in particular, most recently, how do they learn from other people, which is one of the most important ways that they learn. So I started writing and thinking about this, and at the same time, I became a grandmother, now a grandmother of three children under four. And that kind of propelled me back into the caregiving world again. And I realized that a model of what parents and children are all about had become completely dominant in the culture in that same 20 years. And the interesting thing is that that model was totally different, totally the opposite of the model that was coming out of the science. And that was really the impetus for the book. So the title of the book, The Gardener and the Carpenter, is a way of trying to capture in a single image these two really different pictures of relationships between parents and children. Now, the first one, the carpenter model, is also sort of encapsulated in this rather distinctive word, parenting. And it's interesting because parenting, even just as a word, only appeared for the first time in the 1960s in America. And it's become incredibly popular over the 1980s and 90s. So although mothers and fathers are as old as human beings, parent as a verb, is very recent. And that word comes with a kind of picture of what being a parent is about. And this is what I think of as the carpenter picture. So the picture is that it's a goal-directed kind of work, and as with other kinds of work, if you get the right kinds of techniques, the right kind of expertise, then what you can do is shape this child into a good child and thereby produce a good or better adult. Now, quite what better than what is not always very clear in this model. We quietly whisper better than that other child next door. But somehow smarter or happier or more successful or something. And I think the reason why this model appeared was because in this period, for the first time in human history, as we'll see in a moment, people were trying to learn about caregiving by who had never actually taken care of a child themselves. So for most of human history, the way you learned how to take care of a baby was by taking care of your younger siblings and cousins and watching lots of people around you take care of babies. And for the first time, there were people who had spent, say, 30 or 40 years working and going to school, but had not taken care of babies at all. So I think it was very natural to think that the right model for caregiving was this model of that was very much like working and going to school. And a lot of what I argue in the book is that that picture is a terrible picture. It doesn't fit the science, and perhaps more importantly, it makes people miserable without making them happier. It's not good for parents or for children. And now what I'm going to do is just talk very briefly about some of the science that that suggests this. So as I said, one of the areas where there's been really wonderful research is looking at the evolution of human childhood. So one of the things that's most distinctive about us, possibly the thing that is most distinctive about us as a species, is the fact that we have this exceptionally long childhood, this exceptionally long period of protected immaturity. So chimps, for example, are producing as much food as they're consuming by the time they're seven. And even in hunter-gatherer or forager cultures, children aren't doing that until they're 15. And my son is 27, and in our culture, even when they're 27, you're still paying rent and tuition. Now, if you think about it, it seems as if there's something sort of paradoxical about that. I mean, it takes so much work to raise one of these children. Why would we extend that period of work and investment and immaturity? And they're so helpless during that period. Well, it turns out that when you look at the evolutionary record, you see that there's this really striking correlation, and it's a correlation between how long a period of childhood you have, an animal has, how big their brains are, and generally speaking, how smart they are. And the poster birds, animals for this relationship, are actually birds, not even mammals. And crows in general, and New Caledonian crows in particular, are incredibly smart birds. This is a bird that's figured out how to use that hook to get food. On the other hand, this is our friend the domestic chicken, and with apologies to any chicken lovers in the audience, which one is likely to have if you're talking in the Bay Area, they are basically dumb as stumps. So they're very, very good at pecking for grain. They're not much good at doing much of anything else. And the chicken children, chicken chicks, are mature within a very brief, short time, and you can show that they have a lot of the skills that they're ever going to have are there literally from the time they're born. Crows, on the other hand, are working to try to learn how to adjust to many, many different kinds of environments. So you can plug a crow in a lab in Cambridge, give them a wire, they've never seen it before, and they figure out how to use it as a tool. And you see this relationship across the animal kingdom. So the puzzle is why? Why would you see this relationship between a long childhood and a big brain? And if you look at what the crows actually do in this period of... Sorry, so the crow fledglings are... The crows are fledglings for as long as a year. These New Caledonian crows are fledglings for 2 years, which is an extremely long time in the life of a bird. The chickens are mature within weeks or months. Why would that be? Well, when you actually look at what happens in those 2 years that the New Caledonian crows are fledglings, what you see is that basically they spend that 2 years screwing up. So in the wild, what these animals do is they'll take a pandanus palm leaf, they'll strip off the leaves, they'll leave little barbs, they'll nibble on the end of it, make it a sharp point, and then they'll put it in a hole with termites and turn it around and then pull out a termite shish kebab. This amazing ability. And what happens for 2 years is that the young try to figure out how to do this and get it wrong for 2 years. They put it in with the barbs the wrong way, with the thick end in instead of the short end in. And, you know, as we all know from being close to the valley, you know, failing quickly And failing further, that's the way to succeed. The way to succeed is try out lots of things, get lots of information about it, figure out how to do it better. And that seems to be the slogan of evolution as well. So children are there to fail. They're there to try things that are new, attempt something that hasn't been attempted before, see if it works, try it again. Now, the disadvantage of that strategy is that during the time that you're trying and failing, you're going to be helpless. So you need someone to protect you. You need someone to invest in that early R&D period to keep you going and to give you some of the information that you need to be able to succeed. And that seems to be the strategy of the New Caledonian. That seems to be the strategy of the New Caledonian crows. Now, we human beings are further out on the end, as it were, of this distribution than any other animal. So we have larger brains, we have more flexible behavior, we can survive in more different environments, and our children, as I mentioned before, are immature and dependent on us for longer than any other animal. And there's quite a bit of evidence that actually we developed this strategy, what biologists call this life history of a long childhood and lots of parental investment, in the course of evolving to be human. So one of the other things that you see in across many different animals is that, as you might expect, that big brain, long childhood strategy also goes with a lot of investment in caregiving. So for example, these are marsupials, the funny animals that live in Australia. And if you look at the quokka, which is the world's most adorable animal, both in terms of its name and its appearance, and you compare it with the Virginia opossum, they are about the same size. They look very similar. But the quokkas are actually raised by both mothers and fathers, and other animals help take care of the babies. And the babies stay in the pouch for as long as a year. And there's only one baby born at a time. If you look at the possums, on the other hand, the possums have litters of six or seven babies. The moms are the only ones who take care of them, and that takes place for a relatively short time. So they're mature much more quickly than the quokkas. And the quokkas' brains are twice as large as the possums' brains. And comparative psychologists tell me that it's hard to get dumber than a possum. Now, I think for us humans, us human mothers, we often feel more like the possum. But in fact, just during the course of human evolution, we moved in the quokka direction. So one of the things that we know happened in evolution is that we, unlike our closest primate relatives, developed what I think of as the caregiving triple threat. So not only did biological mothers take care of babies the way that chimps or gorillas do, but we developed pair bonding. So we developed men who were involved in caregiving and who were attached to females. That's actually a very unusual pattern among animals. Only 5% of mammals show this pair bonding pattern, and we developed it during the time we were becoming human. We developed what anthropologists call alloparenting, which means that other people who are not kin help to take care of babies. A recent study of foragers showed that babies were breastfed by four or five women during the course of a week, beyond their own biological mother. And then we developed my favorite adaptation, which is grandmothering. So we're the only animal, we're the only primate that lives past menopause. And there's quite an extensive argument now that it was exactly grandmothers who enabled this extended, very, very, very long period of childhood. So we have this really great investment in babies, and that's been part of what it means to be human for as long as we've been around. So the picture is that that investment, what that lets us do is learn. And when we look at the human brain, we see that we're really designed to learn as babies. So this is a chart that shows the development of synapses, brain connections, over time. And what you can see is that there's this early period, just about up to preschool, when many, many, many new connections are being formed, And then there's a later period when the connections that are used a lot are maintained and strengthened, and then the connections that aren't used get pruned, get abandoned. And you can see this pattern of an early brain really designed for learning, designed to be extremely flexible, very good at changing in the light of experience, not very good at doing anything. And you'll see that the prefrontal part of the brain, the sort of executive function, executive office of the brain, is the last part of the brain to mature. Again, if you're thinking about an adult agenda, going out into the world, getting things done, being focused, doing things effectively, then a brain that looks like that late brain, very pruned with just a few very strong connections, is a really good and a lot of executive control. That's a great brain for actually getting things done. Not so good for learning, not so good for being plastic and flexible. The child's brain is a brain that's tremendously good for learning, for trying, for exploring possibilities, not so good for getting your jacket on when it's time for you to go to preschool. Now, if this picture that I've been talking about is right, we might expect that we would see very powerful learning abilities in young children. And the whole second part of the book is about all this amazing, these amazing experiments that have been done over the past 15 years that show just how powerful those learning abilities are. I'm going to just talk about two of those experiments quite briefly. There's two big categories of how children learn. And I talk about them in the book. Learning through looking is one of them, sometimes called observational learning. And what we've discovered is that children just looking at what a grown-up is doing and seeing what the things around them are doing and the way the things around them behave are using learning mechanisms that are as powerful as the smartest scientists that we know about. So they're analyzing statistics, they're doing experiments, they're drawing causal conclusions, and they're doing all this just as they're sitting around watching you cook or clean or talk to other people or watching grown-ups do the things that they do. And the way that we can demonstrate this is by simply giving children real objects, little machines, for example, and showing them patterns of, say, blocks on the machine and effects on the machine. And then we can see whether the children can figure out how the machines work. And in some recent work that we've done, we've shown that actually children are better at making those kinds of inferences than adults, especially if the solution to the problem is unusual or unexpected. So if a machine works in a way that you don't, that isn't obvious, your grandchild is actually going to be better at figuring it out than you are. Now, probably some people in the audience have had this experience with iPhones. I certainly have, where there's some weird thing that your iPhone does that my four-year-old understands much better than I do. But we've actually shown this scientifically. Let me give you another example of how complicated this kind of learning is. This is an experiment that we did in my lab. And here's what we did. We showed children a toy that could do different things. You could squish it or squeeze it or pull the ring. The toy would make music. And the children saw different kinds of sequences of these three different actions. So, as I said, you squish it, you pull the ring, you squeeze the bulb, you pull the ring, and it makes music. Now you pull the handle, and you squeeze the bulb, and you pull the ring, and it makes music. Now, if you were just mindlessly imitating, you might just do exactly what the grown-up did. But if you were like a scientist trying to figure out how exactly does this work, you might figure out that really all you have to do is squeeze the bulb and pull the ring. That's the part that's constant across all these different circumstances. And the first thing that you do is really irrelevant. So what we did was we actually showed children different kinds of patterns of actions. And then we just asked them, can you make the machine go? And here's a cute video.
Yeah, I've never played with it before. So you know what's funny about it? It plays music. But I don't know how to make it play music yet, so I thought that what we could do is we could try some things and see if we can figure it out, okay? You want to help me see if we can figure out what makes it go? All right, so that's going to be your game. We'll see. What makes my new toy play music? What if I squish it, and then I squeeze it here, and then I pull this ring? Oh! It plays music! Should I try that again? All right. I'll squish it. And then I'll squeeze it here. And then I'll pull this ring. Hey! I should try something else. What if I squish it, and then I shake it, and then I pull this ring? Do you hear anything? No, I don't hear anything either.
Okay, so that little four-year-old, if you were like me, you probably were having trouble completely keeping track of everything that was going on there. She does this 10 more times, a different way each of the 10 times. But that little four-year-old is paying attention, because in this case, it's the last two things that actually are the intelligent solution.
Why don't you make it go? Oh, good job!
That's what he did. And we discovered that very reliably, just as I mentioned before, the children would actually, instead of just imitating what the grown-ups did, they would figure out the intelligent, efficient solution to this, even though they'd never seen it before, even though they'd never seen the toy before. So just like the crows, they're trying out possibilities, including possibilities that are not at all obvious, but kind of make sense.
You're listening to child psychologist and author Alison Gopnik, whose latest book is The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children. She's joined in conversation by Dr. Keltner on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Now, the important other thing to say about this experiment is, as you saw, my student, who was actually an MIT computer scientist, was very good at being clueless, one of those things they teach you at MIT. So she presented this in this kind of, I don't know, how does this work? We did the same experiment, but the only thing that we did differently was we had her say, here's my toy, I'm going to show you how it works. Otherwise, the experiment is exactly the same. When you do that, the children never figure out the intelligent solution. Literally never. If I showed you the chart, there's a zero on the bar for the intelligent solution. All they did was imitate what the teacher showed them. And you can see the same effect in the other kind of learning, which is learning through play. And I have a whole chapter about this in the book. And again, there's been marvelous new work showing just how incredibly much children learn through play. This is something that we've had an intuition about for a long time, but we haven't actually had very much, many demonstrations of it. Let me give you an example of a beautiful experiment by my ex-postdoc Liz Bonowitz and ex-graduate student Laura Schultz. What they did was they showed children this toy that had four interesting things that it could do. It had a mirror and a light and so forth, including a squeaker.
And hey, Scarlett.
What about you?
My name is Sydney.
Hi. We showed the children the toy
the
in two different
ways.
The museum
gave me this really weird toy. It's so weird. I've never seen this before. Whoa. Oops. Did you hear that? Did you see that?
And it's weird.
This is a really cool toy, Scarlett. I want you to play with it and see if you can figure out how it works, okay? Can you let me know when you're done playing? Okay, great.
So what she does, as you'd expect any four-year-old to do when they have an interesting toy, is she plays, she pokes, she prods at it, and she figures out all the different things it can do. There's a mirror, and there's a light, and quite characteristically, if you show four-year-olds this kind of toy, they'll figure out all the different kinds of things that the toy can do. But now, suppose you show this the child the toy in a way that's more like the parenting teaching model. Here's what happens.
I'm going to show you my toy. This is my toy. Isn't it cool?
Yeah. And there's the ball in there.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to show you how my toy works, Isaac. Watch this. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Can you let me know when you're done?
Here.
Okay, great.
Okay, so this time she shows him the squeaker, not by accident, as part of this teaching. And here's what he does. You can hear that squeaker? Okay, so we could show you another 3 minutes of that, and all that he does is imitate exactly what the experimenter did again. So these experiments, and these are just two among many, suggest that these very powerful abilities that children have spontaneously to do these very intelligent kinds of learning, this kind of exploration both of the possible ideas that you could have about something and all the physical exploration we call getting into things, those things are built into children. That's what children will just do if you let them loose. And by the way, we've recently done some similar experiments in Head Start programs and in rural Peru, and those children have just the same kind of learning abilities that these children in the Child Studies Center have. But actually, the alternative, the kind of parenting carpenter model, the model where, which is also the, very much the model of schooling, where you're trying to shape the child to do a particular thing, children are also sensitive to being shaped. And when they think they're being shaped, they actually narrow the range of possibilities that they explore. So the moral of the book, why it is that parents care for children, what caregiving is all about, is that parents care so children can explore. So rather than thinking about this carpenter model where you're trying to build a child who comes out a particular way, a better metaphor is think about what it's like to be a gardener. So if you're a gardener, you work very hard and you're up to your ears in manure a lot of the time. But what you're doing is not actually creating a particular kind of plant. If you're a gardener, nothing comes out the way that you expect it to. And there's actually a profound reason for that, which is that what gardening is about is creating a resilient ecosystem. And a resilient ecosystem means a system that's variable, that changes, that has lots of possibilities, that can do completely new, unexpected things when the circumstances around them change. And that really seems to be the model for human caregiving. What human caregiving does is by making this commitment to children, by passing on our values and knowledge to children, it lets them, the next generation, produce things totally different from anything that's been on the face of the planet before. That's what children are all about, and that's what caregiving is all about. So that's the 20-minute summary of a long book, but that's the big point. Let me just say the last thing, since I know there's a lot of ECE people in the audience. It's not a coincidence that kindergarten is called kindergarten and not preschool. Kindergarten was originally intended to be a garden for children. This kind of gardener metaphor has a long history. And I think traditionally people in early childhood education have intuitively understood this maybe better than anybody else. And those early childhood education programs have been an example of the kind of rich group of invested caregivers that we evolved to, that's like our context of evolution. Unfortunately, now one of the bad effects of the parenting model has been that early childhood education teachers are increasingly caught in this kind of pincer movement between parents who want their kids to go to Harvard and have been influenced by the billion-dollar parenting industry on the one hand, and policymakers who want to show that they've got bang for their buck from their investment in early childhood on the other. So there's increasing pressure to make the children look more like that poor child who's just squeaking the squeaker over and over and over again, rather than actually being the exploratory children playing in the garden that I think has been the traditional model of early childhood and the one that I think most early childhood educators still hold. So with that rant, I will have my very unranting colleague, Dacher Keltner, who knows all about good things and happiness, lighten the mood, and we'll talk about the book for a bit.
Alice and I are neighbors in Tolman Hall over at UC Berkeley and have been so for 20 years. Well, first of all, I wanted to congratulate you on a spectacular book, a book that needs to be urgently read by many people. And it's interesting, we just dropped our daughter off at college and then I read your book and I was very nostalgic because I thought about the pressure of today's society to be the carpenter and the missed opportunities for the garden. And then I got to your section on the long childhood and how it takes kids up to 25, 30 years to make food on their own. And I know she'll be coming back, so that was reassuring. But I wanted to give the audience a picture of your intellectual background, which is very unusual, which is Allison has really led a movement in, and it's a very unusual movement that now extends to primate species, for example, which is to think about the deep philosophical questions, and you have a training in philosophy from Oxford, and then to use empirical science. And for that was right at the beginning of psychology, right, with William James grappling with should he be a philosopher, should he be a scientist, and he veered towards psychology. And even more complicated is that you take on the big questions in philosophy by studying infants. So what got you there? Why did you take on that integration of ideas?
Well, you know, I wonder. I was the oldest of six children. So, and I had my own first child when I was 23, when I was in graduate school. So essentially, my whole life, I've been taking care of children. I've been involved and engaged with children, now with my adorable grandchildren. And at the same time, I was always incredibly interested in the big questions of philosophy and also in this kind of rigorous way that you could approach them through science and through cognitive science and through computation. And the thing that struck me from the very beginning was that in spite of the fact that if you ask most people, you know, what's the thing that gives your life meaning? What's the thing that will live past you? They talk about their children.
Yeah.
And yet children are almost invisible in the philosophical and even the scientific
and the scientific literature
tradition.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
At one point I looked at the 1967 Encyclopedia of Philosophy, 2,000 pages of philosophy. There are four references to mothers, fathers, children, babies. You could read all 2,000 years of philosophy and think that human beings reproduced by asexual cloning. you'd have no idea that children existed, let alone that they were profound and deep and part of our lives. So I very early made my vocation, you know, sort of had one of these nice visions of that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to take the profundity and interest and complexity of the children that I was seeing and try to treat that the way that a scientist or a philosopher would.
Yeah. And now we see that in the primate world, for example, and their concerns over justice and so forth. So one of the things that's really striking, and I hope the audience will appreciate when they read The Gardener and the Carpenter, is it really is, it's a tour of what we've learned about the child's mind. Mm-hmm. And you've been right at the heart of that science. So what do you think the big insights are about what we've learned about the functioning of the infant and then the child and teen's mind?
Yeah, so I think the picture, even when I started 30 years ago, and certainly for a long time before that, was that children were sort of defective grown-ups. So they were irrational, they were amoral.
True in our household, I might
egocentric,
add.
Egocentric, They, you know, all the definite, they lived in a buzzing, blooming confusion. And even like Jean Piaget, who was the great developmental psychologist, thought that children couldn't think logically until they were, you know, well into the school age period. And essentially what we found is just about anything that we can try in terms of what they know and how well they are, good they are at learning, it turns out they're better than we expected. Yeah. And I, for 30 years, have been telling my graduate students, nah, come on, let's not even try that. There's no way that three-year-olds are going to be able to do that. And almost every time it turns out that they both know more and learn more, have more powerful learning mechanisms than we ever would have imagined 30 years ago. And now the interesting question, which is part of what comes up in this book, is what, given that we know that, what does that tell us about some practical issues about what we should be like as parents, what we should be like as policymakers? Yeah. And part of the reason for writing the book was that often the because we live in such a schooled society, when you tell people, look, children are learning far more than we ever would have thought, the first thing they think is, oh, so we should teach them more, and we should put them in school settings more and more and younger.
Yeah.
When we're caregiving just as parents, we should function like instructive teachers. And that's so much the opposite of what the science is saying that I wanted to try and convey that message.
Yeah, that early in life, it's about exploration and testing hypotheses, and then we winnow down and get ready for precise knowledge.
Yeah, for in neuroscience, they talk about this, and in computer science, they talk about attention. I like this phrasing about exploration and exploitation.
Yeah.
And the idea is that when you're trying to learn because you have a specific goal. And, you know, I don't want to downplay that. That's how adult life is about, having things that you want to accomplish and focusing and being right on point and ignoring distractions and just figuring out what you want to do. That's exploitation learning. But the danger of that, and I think this is the danger we all know about as adults, is you're so focused on the goal that there might be a really great solution far away that you would discover if you just relaxed and explored and played. And that's, that kind of exploration seems to be what children are all about. Children are literally made for learning. That's what they're for. That's what they're designed for. And that's why we put up with all the hard work it takes to take care of them. But when they learn, they're learning in this explore way rather than the exploit way. They're terrible at accomplishing goals. Again, as anyone who's tried to get a three-year-old to preschool can tell you. And part of it is because, you know, little Georgie is supposed to be getting through the Whole Foods checkout, and there's a little piece of food that's on the floor, and that's kind of interesting, and there's a balloon. Could we go and look at the balloon? And that's, you know, yeah. We all know that's what trying to do something with a preschooler is like.
And in the book, you talk a lot about different paradoxes, and this is a paradox or a conflict of parenting, which is the child is wonder-filled, and the parent is task-focused, and they never get anything done.
Yeah. So. I mean, it's one of the things that I think makes being a parent, which is a way I like to think of it, rather than parenting. I mean, after all, we don't wive our husbands, and we don't friend our friends. Even on Facebook, we don't really friend our friends. We don't
awkward term.
Child our parents. So why is it that we think that we parent our children as opposed to being a parent? One of the things that I think is great about being a parent is that, and even greater about being a grandparent, is that on the one hand, it's the most serious, focused, difficult thing that you ever have to do because you have to take care of these children. On the other hand, you get to be with the children, which means that simultaneously you get a vision of how much more there is in the world than you normally think
absolutely.
About.
Yeah, laughter and play and wonder and all sorts of things. You know, this book is really well-timed. You know, the parent communities that I speak to, you know, surveying the stress and happiness literature like I do
for
different worlds. You know, what we know, and this is part of why I think this book is so profoundly timely, is we know stress in families has risen pretty dramatically. We know kids are working much harder than they did 20 years ago. We know, you know, when there are these studies that are done of the average American family, siblings are having 8 to 10 conflicts an hour, and parents are having 8 to 10 conflicts an hour with one of those children. There's a lot of strife, and I think this book speaks to that. And I think a lot of parents will recognize the carpenter syndrome right away, that we're drilling and we're structuring and we're guiding and we're being didactic when kids are there to learn. So I wanted to have you give us a picture of the other metaphor, which is the garden. So what's in the Gopnik garden in the living room?
Yeah. Well, one thing that I have to say is that if you saw the Gopnik garden, both the actual literal garden and the metaphorical garden, it's kind of a mess, basically. So there definitely are tidier gardeners and caregivers than I am. But I think it's also important to say that one of the things that caregiving does is caregivers, just by exemplifying the values that they have, more even than sort of passing them on, just by being the values they have and by allowing children to participate in the kind of values and knowledge and idiosyncrasies that you have as a parent, that's the mechanism for human culture, which is our great advantage, our great accomplishment. And the way that we do that isn't by shaping. So even if we could shape our children to come out according to some ideal, we would be defeating the whole purpose of childhood and really defeating the whole purpose of having a human brain by doing it. Because the whole purpose of human beings, of our great brains, is that we can, each generation takes the information they've gotten from the previous generation and those values, and now they're in a slightly different, or maybe sometimes a very different environment, and they can take that information, change it, mix it up, adapt it, turn it into something that is really different from what they had before. I was saying before, being here in the JCC, very appropriately, my oldest son, who's the father of the grandchildren, So my grandfather was a Jewish immigrant who went to eighth grade and had a little grocery store in Delhi in Philadelphia that he ran. And then his son went to university, became a university professor. Me, his daughter, went to university, became a university professor. My son is starting an artisanal hipster Jewish deli in Berkeley. It's just going to open up in January, selling Montreal smoked meat and poutine. And he's not quite doing that the way that my grandfather did, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, he's doing it in a self-conscious, he would be appalled at the thought of being a hipster, but kind of hipster, kind of hipster way. And there's this whole movement that's like this, these second, third generation deli guys, right, who all have, you know, degrees from Hampshire College in gender studies and sustainability. That, I think, is a really marvelous, very Jewish example of this kind of sense in which we keep the tradition going.
With evolution.
But it keeps changing, and it keeps changing in ways that are totally unpredictable from generation to generation. And that's what childhood is all about.
Yeah.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features child psychologist and author Alison Gopnik, whose latest book is The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children. She's joined in conversation by Dr. Keltner. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
In many ways, the book is a meditation upon how serious things come out of lighthearted things. Mm-hmm. And so you have wonderful sections on play and the centrality of play to how people achieve the fundamental epistemological tasks of existence, knowing what other people think. I love your section on storytelling. You know, most parents get trapped into the, you know, this ritual of telling the bedtime story. And for me, it involved making up 900 stories about this cat I had in childhood, gray boy. And, you know, eventually my daughter was looking at me like, are these really true or not? You know, but make the case. How do these lighthearted things teach us the deepest truths?
Well, the book is organized in terms of these kind of very foundational, fundamental paradoxes that come from caregiving and come from relationships between parents and children. And one of those deep paradoxes is this relationship between play and work.
Yeah.
So it's very easy, especially in a sort of puritanical society, to think, okay, well, play is okay, but only if it accomplishes something, right? So we need to play, but we need to make sure that when we play, we get something out of the play.
Yeah.
And from a scientific perspective, the interesting idea is that by not trying to be goal-directed, in the short run, you can actually accomplish a much wider range of goals in the long run.
Right.
And that's essentially the human strategy.
Right.
So the human strategy is, in the short run, especially in childhood, we just enjoy, play. And we have all this whole system, as you know, of emotions like curiosity and awe and joy that aren't really, you know, they're not really emotions that come when we want to do something and we're satisfied because we do it. They
right.
come when we're in this kind of broad, open relationship to the world. And those, wonder, curiosity, joy, those are the childhood emotions. And we, in a sense, we undermine that system when we're trying, even when we're playing, to think about what the outcome of play is going to be. So by not trying, we end up being able to have this kind of flexibility that is so characteristically human. And there's really fascinating studies with rats and rats' brains where, you know, even childhood is a period of play across the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
Baby rats will play rough and tumble the way that little boys play rough and tumble.
Hours a day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it turns out that if you deprive rats of the chance to do that, it's not that those rats, there's nothing that the playful rats can do that the non-playful rats can't do specifically. But what they lose is the ability to be flexible. They lose the ability to change what they do a little bit depending on the context or generate a new kind of behavior to deal with a new challenge. So it's not that play does anything in particular, but it lets you do everything in general.
Right. Interesting.
And I think that's an important message for adults, too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, we have a tendency, as you know, when we write our scientific grants, which is really, you know, one of the things I always say is it's not that children are little scientists, it's that scientists are big children. And when I say that at Fermi Lab or at Lawrence Lab, everybody gets up and applauds and completely agrees with that. But, you know, we have to fill out this thing that says, yes, is your science actually going to tell me exactly how this is going to pay off. And artists have to say, yes, this piece of art is going to be morally uplifting or something. And what the science tells us is that's kind of missing the point.
Yeah.
The point is to have the general play, even for grown-ups.
Yeah. So before we take some questions from the audience, I want you to make some bold statements or answer some questions. In light of the gardener and the carpenter, what's your one piece of advice for parents?
Okay. So I have my one sentence. One of the things I argue in the book is I think there's a parallel between my book and Michael Pollan's books about nutrition, where part of what happened is at about the same time that we developed parenting, we developed dieting. There was sort of this parallel process. And in both cases, instead of sort of having these spontaneous cultural traditions, we developed this idea that if only we controlled things in the right way, things would come out well. So my equivalent of Michael's, eat food, mostly plants, is follow your intuition, muddle through, and hope for the best. I think that's probably a good summary of what actual advice to parents would be. And to articulate that a little bit more, you love your kids unconditionally, which is something that all of us are really good at doing, and you love that specific child in spite of the fact that you have no idea what they're going to be like before they're born. They're going to be totally different from any other human being on the planet. You're totally different from any other human being on the planet. You have no idea what the outcome of this interaction, this experiment is going to be, but that's what you do.
Yeah.
And you provide a safe, stable environment for that child, even though you know that the reason for doing that is so the child can go out and take risks and have adventures and experiment and reject the safe, stable environment you've made. And you pass on your values, even though you know that your child will take those values and mash them up and revise them and change them. And that's sort of the picture, I think, that comes out of being the gardener rather than being the carpenter.
And the last question, what would you tell teachers or schools?
Yeah.
And I know you speak a lot to educators.
Yeah, and the book has a couple of chapters also about a lot about early childhood education and some about also about school-age education. And I think there's a very strong parallel between the rise of parenting and the rise of schooling. Those two things are connected to one another. And schools, as we know them, are also a recent invention, only the last 150 years or so.
Yeah.
And they were designed to get people to be able to function in an industrial setting, in factories and so forth. And now, again, one of the ironies is that we're in a world where what we need more and more is innovation and creativity. It might have been that in the 19th century, shaping people to do a particular job in a factory was actually a good idea, but that's something we can do with robots now.
Yeah.
And at exactly the point at which the things that children are naturally so good at, exploration, innovation, creativity, play, are exactly the things that we value, instead, we're taking this 19th century model and we're pushing it down on younger children. So I think, again, the story, I mean, in the case of teachers and certainly early childhood teachers, even more than parents, I think they have all the right intuitions and it's just a matter of being able to follow those intuitions.
Yeah, well put. I think we're going to take some questions from the audience.
So what about when you do want to get your kid out the door with their shoes on and jacket on? Do you have any advice for, as much as we want to be gardeners all the time and play and get down on their level and see them explore, sometimes you just need to get out the door.
Yeah. And then what you do is you pick them up, you take the jacket, you physically put the jacket on them as they're wriggling, and you say, okay, come on, it's time to get out the door. The picture, you know, sometimes when I've talked about this, people say, oh, is this like Summerhill or something that you just leave the children alone? Well, again, if you're a gardener, you know that you don't just leave the garden alone. And I think an important piece is that this piece about you pass on your values and knowledge, that can be very variable. People are really different about what they value, what's important to them. And children are incredible. In fact, I write a column for the Wall Street Journal, and the column I'm writing this week is about a new study that just came out. Children are incredibly sensitive to rules. They're really good at figuring out rules, and they want to figure out rules. So if you say, okay, that's enough playing, now we put our toys away, or now it's time to get out of the house, it may not look as if they're getting that, but the studies actually show that they're picking up the fact that that's the rule. So I don't at all want to convey the thought that somehow, you know, you shouldn't tell your children what to do. Of course you should tell your children what to do. And they'll listen and understand and pay attention and then do what it is that they want to do anyway.
Hi. I'm wondering about the role of culture. And we would assume that in certain situations or our earlier situations, there was a need to develop more quickly. You had to fight the tiger in the jungle or outrun him or something if you grew up in the jungle. What about the role of technology? How is that impacting our children in societies like the people you deal with in Berkeley? I'm assuming people who are here tonight. What role does that play in development?
There's a whole chapter about technology in the book, and I am not, probably am a minority voice, although I'm not sure, because lots of people have reacted by saying, oh, yeah, that was such a good chapter. I am a minority voice in thinking that I think we are panicked about the effects of technology. If you think about this evolutionary picture in which each generation takes the things that the previous generation has done, adopts it, changes it. Think about those New Caledonian crows figuring out how to use the wire. We are a technological species. Yeah. And I think what happens is the technology, one of the things I say in the book is, and I think this is actually true for me too, the day before you're born is Eden, and the day after your children is born is Mad Max. we're always kind of, you know, the technology that we had when we were five, that's not technology, it's stuff, right? Like chairs, right? I mean, chairs, that's not technology, or even, you know, telephones aren't technology, trains aren't technology. But of course, all of those things were technology at the time that they were invented. So and you know, maybe this time is different, but if you actually look, one of the things I was saying to Dacher, Socrates thought that reading and writing was a terrible idea. He has a whole section about how if people read books, they're not going to have Socratic dialogues. They'll read the books and think what's in the books is true because you can't have a conversation with the book. And they'll forget how to remember things. So no one will remember all of Homer once you can actually read it in a book. And he was right. Both of those things are true, and sort of overarchingly, the benefits of reading kind of overpower the deficits. But I think the same thing's going to be true about the next generation of technology. I think one thing that is interesting from the scientific perspective is for us, for me, for grown-ups, new technology really is disruptive. We have to use a lot of energy, even neurologically, a lot of energy and attention to try and master a new technology. But when we master that technology when we're children, we're learning in this completely different, wide-ranging way that means that that technology just kind of becomes second nature to us. Again, for good or for ill. So my view is this picture about culture and change and revision would make you less pessimistic about technology than I think a lot of people are.
I just wanted to ask your opinion about when you're describing play, to me that is creative, imaginative play, which seems a bit endangered as far as how much sport gets brought in. I mean, I'm all for sport as they're older, but it does seem younger and younger, the opportunities to just play hide and seek, all the old games that are part of a lot of different cultures.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things is everybody kind of recognizes that play is a good thing, but it's just, and again, I think this is part of this tension between goal direction and play. But then you have a day that's full of schedules, and there just isn't enough time, whether it's a schedule in a school where you say, okay, let's just cut out that 15 minutes of recess, and then we'll do better on the standardized tests, or whether it's a parent who has the child in Kumin and Mandarin and, you know, soccer and so forth, and just not enough, and is doing an hour of homework. There's just not enough time in the day for play. Sports is something I've been actually thinking about, because there's a lot of evidence that, especially for school-age children, say 7 and 8-year-olds, one of the things that they do spontaneously in their play that makes them different from preschoolers is they organize games. And there's all these, one of my favorite developmental psychology books is not written by a developmental psychologist at all. I talk about it in the book. Iona and Peter Opie, who were folklorists, wrote this marvelous book, which I highly recommend, called The Lore and Language of School Children. And then they wrote a book about children's games. And they just went out and, kind of like anthropologists in the schoolyard, they gathered all this information. And it turns out that for most of history, children have been making up games themselves. Yeah. So if you think about, you guys probably played Foursquare or Wall Ball. And it's still true that if you ask, you know, who... There's no, you know, Hall of Fame of Foursquare or, you know, Wall Ball official rule book. And I think there's a lot of reason to believe that what kids get out of sports, more than just the sports, is, all right, so how are we going to play? What's going to be first base? Do we agree about this? Who's going to have this role? Who's going to have that role? That's a very good practice for the kind of social coordination that Dacher studies that you need as adults. And I think there is a worry about the fact that if... you've got a grown-up who's telling you what to do at recess, who's telling you what the games are. Yeah. You've got some of the physical advantages of playing, but you don't have this kind of creative advantage of inventing and figuring out how the... and negotiating, sometimes with some tension, how the game That's is good, actually going to work. I entirely agree with that. And in the book, I talk about all these really... the play literature is fascinating, especially the animal... literature, because of course you can. There's actually a much bigger literature about animal play than children's play, oddly enough. And there's all these, you know, rough and tumble and creative imaginative play and playing games with rules. They're all kind of and being an adult going to doing drama or doing fiction or doing science. They're all kind of doing the same thing, but each of them works in a different way and seems to enable people to. They all seem to enable people to be resilient and flexible and inventive, but all sort of resilient and flexible and inventive in different kinds of ways.
With that, I want to say thank you to Allison and Dacher, and to especially you for all coming. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was child psychologist and author Allison Gopnik, whose latest book is The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children. She was joined in conversation by Dacher Keltner. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.